Thank you very much, Reinhard, for the introduction. The answer to the question of how one does that is one does it in graduate school and one is foolish. That's what I did. So thank you for this invitation and for the hospitality. It's a real pleasure to be here. Let me, before I read the actual paper, let me just intimate sort of a little bit the structure of it. It's wonderful to have a conference focused on a topic that's as central to anything one could possibly do in humanistic and theological inquiry. And so naturally, some continuities already emerged when I listened to the papers yesterday. The one thing that I'll say is that after listening to Stephen Long's paper and this sort of very sensible caveat that before one ventures into a relational account of human agency, one must sort of acknowledge the logical anteriority of substance to any concept of relationality. And that is certainly true. At the same time, my argument focuses very much on the relational dynamics of persons. And it struck me that perhaps there is a distinction here to be drawn that from a logical point of view, indeed, the substance of the person needs to be in a way granted. And yet, that sort of pertains to the ratio essendi. But when it comes to the ratio cognoscendi, how do people actually become aware of themselves and of each other as persons? I would maintain that a relational model is indeed indispensable. And so in that sense, I will start with, my paper has two parts. The first essentially will just try to sketch very briefly and in naturally in very compressed form that personhood pivots on a dynamic of recognition. And I will try and suggest that accounts of recognition tend to often expire in formal vocabulary, but that in fact the source of recognition, or one might say the way that recognition in actu actually phenomenalizes itself, is through love. And in the second part then, I will focus on two scenes of literature from King Lear and from Eliot's The Wasteland in order to show how modern literature stages recognition, but notably in its failure, that modern literature is principally capturing our sense of the person by showing how personhood is damaged when we fail at human recognition. So let me start, and since I'm fighting a cold, I will occasionally have to pause and have some water. Apologies for that. So I start from the premise that a number of modern philosophical developments, each of them notably diffident or outright hostile to theological reflection, have dramatically impoverished our conception of the human person. In particular, I'm thinking of Hobbes' naturalist, Locke's and Mandeville's hedonist, and the early Hume's skeptical challenges to rational and responsible human agency. In their own ways, and other important differences notwithstanding, these approaches all tend to consider the human being as axiomatically self-contained, though less by choice than in virtue of the allegedly overriding, determinative role that these thinkers accord to embodied passions, sentiments, and desires. In the case of Hobbes and Mandeville, the implacable causality of the passions renders rational, interpersonal exchange a purely adventitious occurrence and ends up reducing the human person to what, in an alarmed paraphrase, Edmund Burke was to call our, quote, naked, shivering nature. At the same time, other 18th and early 19th century writers working in a neo-Stoic or neo-Platonic and humanist tradition undeniably reject the apparent dismantling of the human person by mechanist and reductionist epistemologies. From the Cambridge Platonists via Shaftesbury and Joseph Butler to Rousseau and the early German Romantics, Herder, Goethe, Moritz, Hölderlin, Schlegel, and Schleiermacher, we witness an attempt to shelter the human individual as a dynamic, self-aware, and responsible agent from the epistemological onslaught of naturalism and skepticism. And yet, even so, the later Enlightenment's attempted vindication of something called the self, credited with genuine powers of practical reasoning and moral deliberation, nonetheless tends to conflate the species concept of humankind with the idea of the human person, and thus to beg the main question. For the concept of a self taken to be instantiated by all individuals treats the latter as equivalent and convertible bearers of specific capacities, biological, cognitive, and linguistic. By contrast, the reality of the human person is not grounded in contingent acts of definition or self-definition, but instead pivots on a specific mode of recognition. Person, Robert Spemann has reminded us, is not a what, but a who. Its proper locus is not the discursive, historically fluctuating domain of political, legal, or economic claims and aspirations, but the Augustinian ordo amoris, the domain of virtue, and preeminently that of love, caritas. Fundamentally, the difference here is between a naturalist conception of existence as subjective self-enclosure, homo incurvatus in se, and a model of life wherein the spiritual and ethical place of the person pivots on its relational character within a community of persons. Antecedent to all legal, economic, or taxonomic wrangling, the communio of persons is not a choice or preference, but rather our God-gifted enduring responsibility. It's important, I think, to resist assimilating personhood to a capacity or rights-based notion of the modern autonomous subject. Yet, as I have argued elsewhere, with few notable exceptions, Hegel's account of recognition, Anerkennung, perhaps being one, most political and ethical thought since Hobbes does just that. In some cases, those of Hobbes, Mandeville, Hume, or Schopenhauer come to mind, a radical naturalism leads philosophy to mount a critique of the individual as, in fact, wholly bereft of rational capacities. A naturalist epistemology that discovers, quote, reason to be the slave of passion, as Hume had famously formulated it, is bound to carry over into a pessimist, nihilist, or proto-existentialist ethic. It cannot surprise that where Enlightenment notions of rational self-governance have been thoroughly dismantled by appeals to our supposedly animalistic or hedonist constitution, questions concerning the human person are likely to be granted relevance, are unlikely to be granted relevance or philosophical standing to begin with. Yet that situation remains fundamentally unchanged, even where Enlightenment thinkers respond critically to the extreme naturalism and skepticism of the writers just mentioned. What prompts these efforts is the question, already puzzling to Locke and his heirs, of whether and how an ethical community might be built on so brittle a foundation as the modern individual. Can one plausibly identify as the Archimedean point for a just and ethical community a being defined above all by its claim to autonomy from all other such individuals, and aspiring to live its life within a cocoon of economic, political, and personal rights and preferences? Where individual self-possession and subjective self-fulfillment are taken to designate the very being of the individual, person only signifies as the political, economic, and legal fiction with which Roman culture had identified the idea of persona long ago. Now, on balance, then, writers such as Godwin or Bentham in England, or Fichte, Feuerbach, and Marx in Germany, or, for that matter, Saint-Simon and Comte in France, seem less intent on contesting the model of selfhood they have been bequeathed by the Enlightenment precursors than they are eager to amend what they hold to be the only viable conception of human agency: a constitutively self-enclosed, self-seeking, and self-legitimating being said to draw on its expressive and rational capacities strictly on a discretionary and elective basis. Unable to distinguish between selfhood and personhood, the post-Enlightenment critique of the autonomous subject aims to salvage that very notion as the Archimedean point of all epistemological conquest and ethical justification. Now, a philosophy whose claims remain strictly interior to the finitude of warranted assertability and procedural reason inevitably forecloses on the incommunicable reality of the individual person. for such inquiry is a fortiori only prepared to recognize and engage notions and propositions of its own devising, such that the personhood is construed in strictly formal terms as the bearer of economic, political, and human rights. And yet, for these formal criteria even to be recognized as rationally meaningful and ethically binding, some antecedent teleologically ordered view of the human person has to be presupposed. For to introduce an ensemble of rights or a deontological ought as the sole criterion of human personhood only furnishes us with a definition, but not, alas, with a warrant such as would compel us to honor that definition in thought and practice. Put differently, the very intelligibility and efficacy of sociological, political, or legal definitions of the individual as self-possessed, rights-bearing, and happiness-seeking rests on an underlying normative view, an oblique consensus that this is indeed how personhood ought to be understood. However, Robert Spemann has rightly pointed out, quote, that with persons, esse is not the same as percipi, and the recognition that a person is someone is not reached by analogy with object perception. For even to acknowledge personal status is already to express respect, and hence to grasp in practice, rather than as a formal logical syllogism, that persons are beings that other persons speak to, rather than things merely spoken of. That's Spemann's argument. For human individuals even to feel induced to overcome their ostensible isolation from one another and participate in a social, political, and economic community, some intuitive sense of belonging together and owing their very reality as persons to that relatedness must be presupposed. So as to arrive at a fuller grasp of that underlying reality, we must begin by acknowledging that the convertibility of personhood and communio is something far more elemental than modernity's neo-pagan conception of putatively isolated individuals joined by a social contract solely for reasons of political and economic expediency. Inasmuch as we can understand the human person only within a non-hierarchical and differentiated model of communio, the conceptual and methodological frameworks of contemporary sociology, political science, anthropology, or evolutionary biology are bound to fail us. Concerned with objectivity rather than truth, these disciplines reject from the outset the possibility of any reality anterior and inaccessible to their positivistic conception of knowledge. And it is this incommensurability of modern forms of inquiry with the reality of the human person which prompts me instead to draw on two alternative modes of human inquiry that, profound differences notwithstanding, do at least have this in common, that they don't presuppose, from the outset, all knowledge to be an exclusively verificationist and predicative undertaking. Theology and literature. First, within post-Nicene theology, the Trinity has served as the framework through which to approach the idea of person, and it's essentially relational, as opposed to its contingently social character. Augustine envisions the Trinity as an archetype of an ethical and organic community wherein the identity of the persons comprising that unity is inseparable from their relations, even as it is neither transferentially projected upon nor mimetically derived from the other persons in that community. While arguing that the Trinitarian framework reappears within the human person as a triad of memory, will, and understanding, Augustine takes care not to slip into a faculty psychology such as we find it in Descartes or Kant. Instead, he insists on the mutually constitutive nature of all human capacities. Quote, "When I name my memory, understanding, and will, each name refers to a single thing, and yet each of these single names is the product of all three." The underlying claim here is that the human person is the expression or manifestation of an all-encompassing order, rather than a subject capable of unilaterally fashioning an account of its inner constitution and its relatedness to other human beings. Hence, for Augustine, there is nothing elective or adventitious about human sociality, community, and relatedness. A point to be kept in mind, lest we misread his observation elsewhere that sociale quidam est humana natura. Only then is it clear that person and self belong to different categories, and that, quote, the person can be neither a variety nor a promotion of the individual. Echoing this observation by Gabriel Marcel, Henri de Lubac notes that a person is not an idealized individual, nor a transcendent monad. Yet it is precisely the contrary view that, certainly by the time of Hobbes, prompts modern political philosophy's laborious attempts to reconstruct a form of union and communion in strictly conceptual and anthropomorphic terms. I say reconstruct because any such undertaking, however unwittingly, endeavors to reclaim at a notional level what in Lubac's words amounts to, quote, a real apperception which seizes at a single glance the bond between the personal and the universal, end quote. In speaking of this realization as an apperception, Lubac, I think, means to safeguard against a purely abstract and notional understanding of person and communio. Hence, too, his caveat, quote, that the idea of unity is not unity itself. More recently, Robert Spermann and Robert Sokolowski have shown why human personhood cannot be captured in the modality of discrete propositions, even as legal definitions are undoubtedly required to protect persons from the myriad degradations that a hedonistic, violent, and self-interested human being forever threatens to unleash on them. Spermann in particular has repeatedly insisted on the unconditional dignity of the human person as the ethical ground zero from which all responsible reasoning about interpersonal relations, medical, legal, economic, must issue. Before turning to the unique contribution that modern literature has made to our understanding of the human person, it helps quoting Spermann's response to those who object that a univocal and normative account of the human person is prejudicial to individual differences. Quote, "It is a great mistake to think we must suppress observations of human differences if we wish to do justice to human dignity. The dignity of the person is not touched by such observations, for the dignity of human beings as persons is not an object of cognition, but of recognition, kein Gegenstand der Erkenntnis, sondern der Anerkennung. If we say that someone is a person, we are saying that he or she is someone unique, and this cannot be understood as the chance implication of one predicate or even of an ensemble of predicates. What he or she may be, besides, does not settle who or she, who or what she is. The what we can observe and comprehend. The who is accessible to us only as we recognize something ultimately inaccessible." End quote. To argue, rightly I think, that the human person is an object of recognition is precisely not to adopt Kant's account of recognition as a case of disembodied respect. Kant's word is Achtung, and it's actually very interesting to observe that there's a sort of semantic shift between Achtung in Kant and Anerkennung in Hegel. It's sort of also a sociological shift. Achtung has very much a kind of ancien regime resonance to it. Anerkennung implies an egalitarian model. Respect in Kant procedurally affirms a person's dignity, Würde. It does so, however, only on the premise that he or she is categorically and irremediably separate from me. Kant's is a decidedly third-person ethic of enigmatic, quasi-noumenal minds, other minds, rather than of a living and dynamic thou. Hence, Kantian respect remains an abstract value concept that ought to be accorded to an equally generic concept of the individual for reasons that Kant ultimately cannot specify. Pivoting on a strictly formal model of recognition, respect affirms nothing in particular about the reality of this person facing me right here and now. That one ought to accord another person respect Thus, that does not illuminate the idea of the human person, but instead shows Kant's moral theory to rest on a tacitly normative conception of personhood. Yet Kant avoids drawing out this foundation for his moral ought, sollen, since acknowledging its indemonstrable roots in the reality of the human person would entangle his case in an ontology for which he could never produce a satisfactory warrant. For a more capacious understanding of recognition, we turn to Hegel, who conceives of it as a necessarily reciprocal, and hence as creating as necessarily reciprocal, and hence as creating the necessary conditions for moral agency in the first place. Rather than being unilaterally extended to or withheld from other autonomous selves, recognition, Anerkennung, here constitutes the very source of sociality. On Hegel's account, recognition shows all rational agency to be bound up with the, quote, moral substance, das sittliche Wesen, of the state. In his dialectic of master and servant, Hegel thus demonstrates how the Enlightenment axiom of absolute self-determination fails on its own terms. For the master's putative autonomy and self-mastery demands recognition by the servant, thus leaving the master unable to account for, quote, the need that sends people after recognition in the first place. As Hegel points out, any hierarchical form of sociality requires the master's perennial quest for recognition by the servant. Yet such recognition can never truly satisfy, because it is being conferred by someone supposedly undeserving of recognition in turn. Hegel's discussion of lordship and bondage thus exposes a fundamental incoherence of accounts that reduce the human person to an isolated, self-grounding, and self-possessed individual. And yet, in framing the relation of the two self-conscious beings, as he phrases it, agonistically as a duel to the death, ein Kampf auf Leben und Tod, this being Hegel's cheerful formulation, Hegel also occludes the elemental and most important dimension of personhood. For what Hegel's critique of Kantian autonomy reveals is only a failure of formal logic. To be sure, Hegelian recognition evinces rationality and sociality to be convertible, and it also shows how modern social theory perennially struggling with the phenomenon of human relatedness and community. Yet Hegel himself does not name that antecedent reality, but instead simply treats the relational model of human personhood as a fact, warranting the critique he means to pursue. As a result, the reality of the human person only emerges into view ex negativo, from certain logical flaws that confound Enlightenment ideas of autonomy. What goes unnamed is the positive source or ground for this formal logical impasse. After all, what alerts us to the reality of human personhood is not simply the formal logical impasse and ultimate failure of Kantian autonomy. Rather, personhood has its own distinctive and intrinsic phenomenology. So how then may we approach the antecedent reality that is being obscured, perhaps even repressed, by the Enlightenment's insistence on the primacy of the solitary individual and by its ex post facto and strictly discretionary sense of recognition? To answer that question, I believe we must turn to a consideration of love as the source of personhood. What modern epistemological, moral, and political accounts of the individual overlook or reject for supposedly lacking a compelling warrant is the fact that recognition not only presupposes an underlying sense of relatedness, but that such communio is essentially phenomenalized as love, caritas. Strictly speaking, recognition of other persons is not a choice, let alone a value-neutral one. Rather, it is a reality to which, rightly understood, we have already assented, even as the pride and lust of dominion often cause us to disfigure, or indeed disavow that assent. Understood as a manifestation of trust and hope in our mutual relatedness as persons, love is ontologically distinct from desire. Indeed, few things testify as poignantly to the desiccated anthropomorphism of modern thought as its insistent effort to assimilate the suprapersonal reality of love to the mechanistic operation of desire, whether manifested as random cupiditas or as an implacable libido dominandi. In either permutation, desire inevitably severs the essential bond between love and recognition, and thus ends up consigning the human person to the realm of the notional and the unreal. Sansa speme vivemo in disio, without hope we live in desire, Dante tells us in the Inferno. In time described by Hegel as the first stage of self-consciousness, desire reigns triumphant in a world from which grace, charity, and hope have seemingly been expunged. In its attempted reduction of the epiphanic to the anthropomorphic, human desire, like an old photograph, ends up exposing time and again the negative of despair from which it falsely promises to extricate us. A quintessential misconstrual of love, desire recognizes the self in relation to others, even as, qua desire, it hastens to repudiate communio and relatedness as threats to the prideful dominion of the modern autonomous self. In what time remains, I wish to take up two literary instances of precisely this failure of charity and the loss of human personhood that it precipitates. In a well-known reading of King Lear, Stanley Cavell has shown Shakespeare's play to be shaped throughout by, quote, the attempt to avoid recognition, the shame of exposure, and the threat of self-revelation, end quote. The play's notorious opening scene, Cavell argues, gives Lear exactly what he wants, that is, what a bribe can buy, false love, and, second, a public expression of love, that is, he wants something he does not have to return in kind, something which his division of property fully pays for, and he wants to look like a loved man. And until Cordelia speaks, the plan is working. Yet contrary to Goneril and Regan, who have no difficulty offering rhetorical, pretended love where they feel none, Cordelia recoils from this perversely staged scene of love and recognition, finding it impossible, quote, to pretend to love where you really do love, as Cavell puts it. The play's opening scene thus becomes so agonizing and confused, at least in part because in her enforcing her to betray her love publicly, Lear confronts Cordelia with the specter that her father may, in fact, be incapable of love, perhaps even have been so all along. Lear's terror of love and recognition resonates throughout the play, such in his late defiant exclamation in the presence of Gloucester, "Do thy worst, blind Cupid, I'll not love." The horror descending on Cordelia in the opening scene, then, stems from her father's gratuitous and cruel staging of love and recognition as a one-sided public spectacle. Lear's insistence on conspicuous affirmations of filial love appears, at least in part, prompted by his fears of political irrelevance and death as he prepares to surrender his crown and thus unburthened crawl toward death. The king's unhappy staging of his own abdication as a public spectacle, a particularly fine case of Shakespearean metadrama, also exposes a long-standing ambiguity in the word person. On the one hand, person had long been associated in pagan Greco-Roman culture with theatrical, legal, and political action. One etymological account, though contested by some, derives person from the funnel-shaped opening in an actor's mask, through which his speech could resonate, personare. Not contested, however, is the association of person in Roman political and theatrical culture with legal and dramatic oratory. To be a person, on this account, is to inhabit and enact a role. The strong association of person with public performative speech paradoxically gives it an impersonal cast, this being precisely the implication so distressing to Cordelia in the play's opening scene. Asked to tender false coin for a love she truly feels, Cordelia begins to fathom a terrifying psychological void in her father, a fear of recognition on his part that now renders speaking the love she has always felt just as impossible as exchanging it for its rhetorical counterfeit. Faced with her father's terror of recognition, the silence of nothing seems her only refuge. Quote, unhappy that I am, I cannot heave my heart into my mouth. It is in her pained reply that Cordelia recalls a more profound, because essentially relational, understanding of personhood. On this view, person pivots on a loving recognition that cannot be mapped onto public roles conceived and enacted by isolated and discretionary selves. Here, the human person is associated not with a rhetorical officium or theatrical mask, but with the human face, whose reality and presence the post-Nicene fathers had sought to access through the concept of hypostasis. Grappling with the unhelpful semantic proximity of the Greek hypostasis and the Latin substantia, Augustine in De Trinitate begins to move away from the lingering reification of person as a self-contained substance of sorts and toward an understanding of person wherein identity and relatedness are both accepted as distinct but inseparable features of personhood. It is in late antiquity, then, that the tension between a public performative and a relational concept of person become more pronounced. Social rank and the dignity conferred by public office are still invoked as criteria for personhood in Boniface and Alanus ab Insulis, and they are confirmed, albeit ex negativo, by the common moralism of Deus personam hominis non accipit, God will not give consideration to one's status. For Alexander of Hales, person is to be taken strictly as a moral term, nomen moris, whose true depth and import we can only fathom by disentangling it from the pagan web of its rhetorical, political, and theatrical enactments. Yet that tension, as Shakespeare's King Lear so powerfully shows, has never been resolved, but on the contrary remains indelibly woven into subsequent theological and philosophical accounts of personhood, and indeed into our own experience of what it means to be a person. Lear's failure vis-à-vis his daughters does not involve treating them as subalterns. It is not a failure of Kantian respect that causes the play's opening scene of recognition and acknowledgement to miscarry in such spectacular fashion. Rather, his opening injunction, which of you, shall we say, doth love us most, shows Lear withholding recognition of his daughter's personhood. He also gratuitously disputes their capacity for filial love by declaring himself the skeptical arbiter of that love's public enactment. The result is a scene that renders those in attendance, the lords of France and Burgundy, embarrassed voyeurs of a process of depersonalization that will ultimately claim father and daughters alike as its prey. Lear's is an extreme and unfiltered case of need love, to recall C.S. Lewis's term, the place where love is swallowed up by the naturalist dynamics of desire, a state infinitesimally removed from the divine gift love that delights in the fullness and presence of its recipient, because in it there is no hunger that needs to be filled, only plenteousness that desires to give. With his gratuitous demand for ostentatious recognition of his fatherly and regal persona, Lear establishes a pattern subsequently followed by a great deal of modern literature. Responding to what I had earlier sketched as philosophy's impoverished view of rational and responsible personhood, modern literature, beginning with Dante, remains profoundly concerned with the reality of the human person, its integrity forever besieged by voluntarist, hedonist, and self-legislating models of the self. Yet in contrast to patristic and scholastic models of personhood, modern literature can secure its fleeting intuition of the human person's transcendent reality only ex negativo. Thus, modern narrative typically centers on the slow deterioration or conspicuous failure of love, community, and hope. Time and again, the plot structure and thematic particulars of canonical narrative revolve around the failure of the gift of love, itself the ultimate source of all recognition and communion. In writers such as Stendhal, Flaubert, or Thomas Hardy, when the an unflinching naturalism invests their dystopic accounts of love and the consequent failure of personhood with an aura of existentialist inevitability, one for which the writers themselves notably cannot envision any remedy. From a strictly theological point of view, one might indeed conclude that modern narrative arises from and perversely celebrates the sin of despair. Yet there are other, rarer instances, such as Tolstoy's Anna Karenina, Dostoevsky's The Idiot, George Eliot's Daniel Deronda, where something else seems to happen. Here, an antiphonal arrangement of the major dramatis personae exposes hedonistic and naturalist models of selfhood as wholly self-defeating. Exceptional cases, such as Daniel Deronda, Konstantin Levin in Anna Karenina, or Prince Myshkin in Dostoevsky's The Idiot, show that achieving human personhood demands transcending the self vertically rather than expanding its scope horizontally. And they do so by gradually extricating the gift of love from its counterfeit, desire. In so confronting the Enlightenment's deeply problematic legacy, some modern writers seek to tabulate the horrendous psychological and spiritual damage wrought by an axiomatic embrace of the disembedded and volitional self. In so doing, some of them, I'm thinking specifically of Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, and T.S. Eliot, also find themselves driven to reflect on the potential limits of literary knowledge. And in a few exceptional cases, they end up abandoning the template of realist narrative that in the course of the 19th century had become enmeshed with modern liberalism's Pelagian vision of individual self-fulfillment and human-engineered salvation. In rare instances, lyric forms in particular serve to reclaim within the modern vernacular impersonal and contemplative possibilities that had gone all but untapped since the writings of Dante or Julian of Norwich. I'm thinking here in particular of the experimental modernism of Gerard Manley Hopkins and T.S. Eliot, and it is from the latter that I would like to draw my closing example of a canonical text meditating on the elision of personhood and its sources in Caritas and Communio. Modeled on Buddha's sermon about worldly things to be consumed by fire, part 3 of Eliot's The Wasteland offers one of the more despondent moments of interpersonal failure and sin found in modern literature. The scene is the grimy metropolitan dystopia of London, the unreal city filled with empty bottles, sandwich papers, silk handkerchiefs, cardboard boxes, cigarette ends, a disenchanted place from which the nymphs are departed and have left no address. The fire sermon, that being part 3, features a speaker condemned, like his mythical forebear Tiresias, and like Eliot's poetic and intellectual alter egos, Dante and Pascal, to foresee and ponder the inevitable miscarriage and seemingly boundless depravity of humankind. The particular scene in question involves the encounter between a humble typist and a nameless clerk, whom she has invited for dinner. Her confused expectations of romantic love and unrequited desire arise from an all-encompassing sense of her banal, loveless, and insubstantial existence, lived out in the flatline durée of modern chronometric time. A female pendant to Prufrock, who, in a memorable phrase, has measured out his life with coffee spoons, the typist's bewildered role in the downward transposition of romantic love into impersonal desire also recalls Prufrock's dissociated experience of life as a solitary and meaningless sequence of prevarications. Time yet for 100 indecisions. Here then is the main passage, and it is a longish one. At the violet hour, when the eyes and back turn upward from the desk, when the human engine waits like a taxi, throbbing, waiting, I, Tiresias, though blind, throbbing between two lives, old man with wrinkled female breasts can see at the violet hour, the evening hour that strives homeward and brings the sailor home from sea, the typist home at tea time clears her breakfast, lights her stove, and lays out food in tins. Out of the window perilously spread her drying combinations, touched by the sun's last rays. On the divan are piled, at night her bed, stockings, slippers, camisoles, and stays. I, Tiresias, old man with wrinkled dugs, perceived the scene and foretold the rest. I, too, awaited the expected guest. He, the young man carbuncular, arrives, a small house agent's clerk, with one bold stare, one of the low on whom assurance sits as a silk hat on a Bradford millionaire. The time is now propitious, as he guesses. The meal is ended. She is bored and tired. Endeavors to engage her in caresses, which still are unreproved if undesired. Flushed and decided, he assaults her at once. Exploring hands encounter no defense. His vanity requires no response and makes a welcome of indifference. And I, Tiresias, have foresuffered all and acted on this same divan or bed, I who have sat by Thebes below the wall and walked among the lowest of the dead. Bestows one final patronizing kiss and gropes his way, finding the stairs unlit. She turns and looks a moment in the glass, hardly aware of her departed lover. Her brain allows one half-formed thought to pass. Well now, that's done, and I'm glad it's over. When lovely woman stoops to folly and paces about her room again, alone, she smooths her hair with automatic hand and puts a record on the gramophone. Their existential solitude only compounded by their fleeting encounter, Eliot's nameless characters verge on allegories of spiritual destitution and an utter misapprehension of love. Adrift in the dystopic metropolis and defined solely by their humdrum occupation, the clerk and the typist barely register the profound harm wrought by their hapless and fleeting encounter. The clerk's furtive departure, he gropes his way, finding the stairs unlit, faintly records the pagan naturalism of Protagoras and Democritus, resembling as it does the trajectory of an atom, unintelligible to the clerk himself, yet foreseen with harrowing accuracy by the latter-day Tiresias of Eliot's speaker. Yet precisely because Tiresias has foretold and foresuffered all, the wasteland cannot be assimilated to a standard narrative of cultural decline. Rather, the seeming impossibility of love and recognition in present-day London accentuates the neo-pagan character of modern naturalist epistemologies and the dissociated secular and hedonist psychology to which they have given rise. Here, Augustine's Ordo Amoris has been supplanted altogether by the shifting idols of subjective preference, such as the implacable twin axioms of self-possession and self-fulfillment. An unwitting reenactment of mythical cruelty long ago foresuffered by Tiresias, Eliot's fire sermon unfolds with bland exemplarity the neo-pagan failure of love, recognition, and personhood, as it transpires daily, we must assume, in the modern deracinated metropolis. And yet, simply to speak of failure is to obscure the main issue. To see why this is so, we might recall Heraclitus' remark that, quote, although logos is common to all, most people live as if they had a wisdom of their own, also found as an epigraph to Eliot's four quartets later on. Heraclitus and following him Eliot are not just identifying a failure, but intimating a fault. For to embrace the solitary and hermetic self as the only way of being in the world is still to choose and to embrace a stance, however intellectualized, for which we then are responsible. The palpably dehumanizing and ethically indefensible actions of the clerk cannot be construed as inevitable entailments of his seemingly natural, feral disposition. Rather, the clerk bears as much responsibility for his unrepentant hedonism per se as he does for violating the spirit of the meal, a failed Eucharist if ever there was one, to which he has been received as, quote, the expected guest. His existentialist way of being cannot be justified, at least not without sophistry, as a mere default of some strictly immanent and inexorable force operative within him, some version of Bias's pure nature. In fact, a person's nature is not something inexplicably received, but rather a potentiality progressively realized and confirmed in the temporal order of acts and habits. As Coleridge was to put it, the nature or character, Greek ethos, of a person arises from a, quote, mysterious diversity between the injunctions of the mind and the elections of the will. Something of the sort probably led Abraham Lincoln to surmise that every man over 40 is responsible for his face. The nature that precipitates with such seeming inevitability the clerk's predatory behavior is ultimately something he himself has made, and for which he bears responsibility. With his admonition, ubi peccata ibi multitudo, ubi autem virtus, ibi unio, Origen had long ago had stressed, that what preempts recognition, what disfigures love as desire, and what erodes the fullness and presence of persons in communion is not some contingent failure, but something rooted in the order of deliberation, choice, and will. The so-called failure of personhood is not a failure at all, but rather a case of sin. Eliot's clerk sins against the imago Dei, not only of the typist, but just as plainly also against his own. Read against the backdrop of Eliot's carefully embodied allusions to the rape of Philomela, the impersonal and dispiriting encounter here unfolded proves, if anything, more ghastly yet. For in modern secular and casually hedonistic culture, the violation of love, and thus of the human person whose reality and flourishing essentially arise from it, has become the new normal. This is what makes the scene's closing line so particularly disturbing. With seismographic sensitivity, Eliot's writing registers the slightest tremors of spiritual anguish in the typist's half-formed thought. Well, now, that's done. Even more poignant are the distracted and mechanical movements. She smooths her hair with automatic hand and puts a record on the gramophone. Acts with which the nameless woman defends against the encroaching awareness of her person's violation and self-abasement. At its strongest, this is what modern literature does. To capture the human person's grounding in the dynamics of recognition and love, if only ex negativo, by showing how the failure of achieving personhood is ultimately one of will, not nature. Needless to say, it is a proposition wholly at odds with modern liberalism's essentially Pelagian understanding of self-legislating and self-contained human existence. Thank you.